When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
HD Smartcast.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to A View from the Stands, a podcast series in which we discuss the new normal in the world of sports. I'm Aditya Iyer, and with me is the national sports editor of HD, Rudranil Sengupta. Welcome to a new episode of A View from the Stands, where our topic for the week is Romain Grosjean's accident over the weekend at the Bahrain Grand Prix. You know what happened. If you don't, you know his car smashed into a barrier in the first lap, split into two, spilled a lot of fuel, which caught fire rapidly, and somehow... And thank God, Grosjean kind of leapt out of this fireball that would have certainly have ended his life a few years ago. This brings us to the focus of this week's episode, which is the unbelievable and ever-evolving safety standards in Formula One, which has seen more lives saved than lost, despite some pretty horrific accidents since the death of Ayrton Senna in 1994. So let's get on with it by turning to my co-host, Rudra, who has a thing or two to say about what we witnessed over a very, very somber Grand Prix.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I the moment I saw that footage, for a second, I thought, you know, there is no way anyone can survive that, because the car basically exploded. And there was a full fireball, and then out comes the driver, you know, and it was almost miraculous. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was chilling and a relief. And I saw it multiple times. I kept playing it to see him coming out of that fireball. Then the moment I saw that, I was thinking, you know, how does anybody survive that? And so I began to kind of look up what, you know, the safety standards of Formula One racing are. And it was incredible. It was a rabbit hole of information. Of the absolute like limits of what you can get in terms of performance material, in terms of car design, in terms of safety design, and that are used here. And if, like, you know, for example, every single material that's in use in from the driver's clothing to the car, what the car is made of, these are things that are used in the aerospace industry. These are things that are used in the Martian rover or a moon lander, you know, to be able to withstand that kind of extremes of temperature and pressure. And this is the same stuff that goes into making the cars, into making their clothes, into making that survival cell about which we'll talk, I'm sure.
Yeah, spot on. Because as you so rightly said, you know, a car splitting into two and spilling fuel, which basically explodes into this gigantic fireball, is not a scene that you really want to witness in sport or anywhere. But to see a guy survive that is just absolutely fabulous, because, you know, Grosjean and accidents kind of go hand in hand. He's been quite reckless for a while, but it's just amazing to see that the sport and seeing just how safe it's gotten over time. And, you know, a lot of the evolution per se of these safety standards have been over the last 20 years, because, you know, before that, Formula One was just like really fast cars driving around tracks around Europe, predominantly, mainly in England, where it started, with fans standing some, you know, a meter and a half away from the track, just the way you see them in the Tour de France. even today and cheering for their team and their favorite drivers. Can you imagine?
Drivers wearing whatever they felt like.
Basically. Whatever they felt like, right? Exactly.
Jacket. Yeah.
Precisely. But all this kind of, you know, really started changing when the crazy weekend in 1994 in Imola, the San Marino Grand Prix, happened. This, of course, was it kind of culminated with the three-time champion Ayrton Senna's death. But that weekend was a bit, you know, morbid throughout, because in the practice session on Friday, Rubens Barrichello, who was later known to be Schumacher's most successful partner in Ferrari, this was, you know, a really young Barrichello in Jordan, where he kind of smashed into a tire wall, landed on top of it, which, you know, you were telling me about before we started recording this podcast, right? Like the fact that tire walls weren't the greatest barriers because they just like kind of, you know, didn't soak up the impact the way the new barriers do. And
they soak up the impact, but then they also throw some of it back, like, you know, like you would with the trampoline. So cars would kind of hurtle over it, which is different from the carbon fiber crumple zones that are in place right now, which just keep crumpling and absorbing without giving any of the energy back.
That's spot on, exactly. Because when the tire walls gave way to the new Tech Pro barriers, which was, of course, of the synthetic material, that was only first regulated in 2006, years after that crazy weekend that we're talking about, right? So basically, Barrichello was airlifted out of there. And then during qualifying, Roland Ratzenberger, who was then driving for Simtek, slipped off a chicane and crashed into a wall at 315 kilometers per hour and was dead on arrival at the hospital. This kind of completely rattled everyone on the circuit before the race the next day. Mostly Ayrton Senna, who was, you know, already thinking about retirement and moving out of there. And Ratzenberger, I think, was a friend of his. And when he crashed the following day during the race, they found an unfurled Austrian flag on his lap in the cockpit as a tribute to Ratzenberger that he would have unfurled had he won the race. He too was dead on arrival. And I think this really, really shook up Formula One as it should have done. And yeah, credit to them that they've possibly made it into one of the safest places to drive. As you know, Narayan Karthikeyan said once, he said, I'm not worried in a Formula One cockpit at all. I'll survive. It's the streets of Madras where I'm really afraid.
Well, bang on, Karthikeyan.
Spot on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but I mean, and the reason why you mentioned how much time it takes, and in 2006 the new barriers got ratified, for example, and the reason is that the reason why it takes so much time is because inherently Formula One is automobile racing is a very, very dangerous sport. I mean, it's a real nightmare. How do you make something where things are moving at that speed, you know, with controls being at that edge, you know, where you just a millimeter on a fraction and you can go completely flying off the track. How do you make something like that is inherently so dangerous safe? For example, the thing that Grosjean said saved him, the halo, only came into being in 2018. And what it is, basically, it's like a wishbone shaped structure. It's like a girdle shaped structure that sits right in front of the driver.
Is it made of titanium?
It is made of titanium. Yes, that's right. It's made of titanium. It was originally made of steel. When the idea first came in 2015, the first prototype was made of steel, and they threw tires at it. You know, 20 kilo tires at it using a nitrogen powered cannon, and the tires would hit it at about 225 kilometers per hour, and it would rebel that. And the halo that we see right now, which is this really flimsy-looking structure, actually, if you look at it, it's nothing, right? That is lighter than the steel one, and it can repel forces even bigger than those 220 kilo tires coming at you at 225 kilometers per hour. But it was so difficult to get this in because, see, the halo sits right in front of the driver. So the driver sees a little T in front of him, and then it curves around his head in a hoop, and it gets attached to the back of the seat. Now, problem is with visibility. I mean, does it, because any which way, a F1 driver's visibility is a very, very precisely calculated thing. There's a very narrow, really a very narrow view that they have, because they're so far down into the seat of the car, because they have to keep the center of gravity so low so that the cars can turn at that speed. So everything about it is like, you know, you move anything by even half an inch and everything can get thrown out of gear. So to actually put something that impairs visibility in front of the driver was a problem. The next problem was, how much time does a driver need to get out of that cockpit in case of an accident? Now, the regulations say you have to get out in 5 seconds. And in fact, before every race, drivers have to prove that they can get out of the cockpit in 5 seconds to race marshals. And the putting that structure immediately makes it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Right? So the regulation
It's one more hurdle, one more obstruction to get out.
One more hurdle, it's one more obstruction. So the regulation changed because it took 2 more seconds now. So now the regulation is that you have to get out of your car in 7 seconds instead of 5. But they made this trade-off because of the incredible amount of protection that tiny little, you know, wishbone-shaped structure gives to a driver. Because what happened with Grosjean is when the car hit that barrier, that halo took all of the impact. If it wasn't there, his head would have taken the impact. But the halo actually pushed the part which hit the halo. The halo made sure that structure got pushed above Grosjean's head. So Grosjean's head was completely protected when he went right through the barrier. And he went through it at incredible speed. As you said, the car broke off. And we'll speak about a little bit more about that, because that essentially means that the safety protocols were working.
Precisely. So 2 points there, right? It's the halo plus something that existed even before 2018, which is the monocoque, right? The survival cell of the Formula One car, which basically is made of carbon fiber. And as you so correctly said a little earlier, which is, how do you turn a sport that is so inherently dangerous into something that's safe? And here the big question was not just for the drivers, who are, of course, wearing their fireproof clothing and, you know, the track itself is wide and there's rubble and debris to, like, you know, break the force before they go and smash into the ever-evolving barrier a meter away from the track and enjoying this amazing spectator sport, right? The answer was, after a very, very, very long time, carbon fiber. Because without carbon fiber and the increase in that technology, which basically gave the driver a protective sheath inside his car, which is known as the monocoque. He was, you know, always in trouble, but so was the spectator, because if he crashed the car, right, the little nuts and bolts flying out of the untethered tire could basically turn into bullets and kill people. It's happened in the past, not in Formula One, but it's happened in motor racing.
Yeah.
So the first thing they did was to tether the tire to the Formula One car to make that a mandatory ruling, right? So that when you crash into something and the tire is flying off, it doesn't hurt other stewards and spectators.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, of course, was, and the big thing was with the absolute growth of carbon fiber, right? Because it completely changed the scenario in Formula One. Of course, there was always a cockpit that was safer than almost any other place on a Formula One track. But the moment you had carbon fiber introduced to both the barriers and the Formula One car, and with excessive testing over, you know, different parts of the chassis, like including the front nose, how carbon fiber comes into the picture once it snaps off, the game changed completely. I mean, between Senna's deaths 1994 and 2013, there were absolutely no fatalities in Formula One. That, of course, changed with the passing of Jules Bianchi, where, you know, it had very little to do with the fact that the technology at that time, however great that was, there was always one in scientific error that was going to kind of slip under the radar. Wet conditions, the worst possible conditions, wet conditions, he smashes into not a barrier, but, you know, a recovery vehicle. And yet modern medicine kept him alive for the next 8 months, even after he was airlifted out of there. He didn't survive. And since then, absolutely no fatalities, right? And yesterday, or the Bahrain Grand Prix, would have and should have been won in any other case. But yeah, absolutely fabulous.
So interestingly, it's the Jules Bianchi accident that actually led to the introduction of the halo. It was right. That year that Mercedes came up with the prototype. And the next year and the next season after that, 16 and 17, they extensively tested it, and in 2018 they introduced it. But when they were testing it, they found out that in the way that Jules Bianchi's car crashed and what happened to him, which was essentially his head did not make impact with anything, the halo wouldn't have helped at all. It would have made no difference to that accident, unfortunately. I see. And in fact, they also tested it with, if you remember, Felipe Massa had this spring which was about half a kilo, you know, and it came at around 300 or 350 kilometers per hour at his face, broke off from a car in front of him, and they tested that, and they found that there is a possibility that there was about, I think, some 25-30% possibility that the halo would have blocked that. So of course it's not foolproof, but it's better than, it's much better than nothing, and as we saw with Grosjean's case, a complete lifesaver. And talking about carbon fiber and the monocoque, so the monocoque, which is basically the cockpit, it's called that because it's kind of, it's treated as a single and distinct entity in the car. Right?
Absolutely.
Which is why when we saw Grosjean's car break apart, that's what it's meant to do. What it's meant to do is that basically the rest of the car is a crumple zone around the cockpit. So when an impact happens, depending on the magnitude of the impact, different parts of the car will just fall off. It'll crumple, absorb the impact, fall off. It'll keep that little cockpit safe from
which the is exactly incoming, what happened in Bahrain.
Yeah, from the incoming impact. The cockpit remains safe. The cockpit itself is made up of very many layers of carbon fiber, which is attached to a very interesting material called xylon. Basically, you know, Formula One is an advertisement for DuPont, the American chemical company, because all of these man-made material that is used, which has this remarkable thermal properties, all come from DuPont. Xylon is one of them. Xylon is extremely non-conductive. It's highly flame-proof and heat-proof. And also it has extremely high tensile strength. So what happens is that even if those layers of carbon fiber start absorbing energy and breaking off, they are not going to splinter because the xylon holds them together. So you know how sometimes you see this kind of special glass that's made which can shatter completely, but it won't splinter and it won't fall off. You know,
correct.
It just, it's like a spider web of cracks.
Yes.
Which is what will happen to the cockpit if it...
Uh-huh.
You know, if it faces stress because of this combination of carbon fiber and xylon. So that's what the cockpit is supposed to do, and which it did very, very well in this case. You know, the entire car kind of broke apart, but that monocoque remained stable and it kept Grosjean safe inside. And of course, he was wearing another, the clothes that they wear, which are also highly flame and fire retardant, is made of a material called Nomex, which is also a DuPont material, which is supposed to be, if you believe their, you know, sales pitch, and there's some scientific evidence to prove this, that it is the most non-conductive material that you can find. Right? And these are all things that are used.
That has ever been created on Earth. That's pretty awesome. Used in Formula One now.
Yeah, and so these are used in, if firefighters use it, they're used in military as part of body armor. They're used to clad those space rovers and moon landers and things like that are clad with this material outside so that they can withstand the temperature and the pressure. So all of those things. And so that's what, you know, those are all these very, very advanced scientific leaps that that really helped a man survive.
Brilliant. Before I wrap this episode up, I just want to inform our listeners that I really wasn't faffing back in the beginning when I said that, you know, the spectators stood right by the track as these, you know, incredibly fast projectiles were driving past. I just went to the F1 safety page. In 1970, there was the first ruling that fans must stand at least 3 meters behind the racetrack. All right. In 1975, fireproof clothing was first introduced. In 1979, when the cockpit openings were made a little wider for the drivers to jump out within those stipulated whatever seconds. Now it's 5, which has been increased to 7 because of the halo. But that back then, it would have been a little more just so that, you know, the driver could get out and could prove that he could get out before a race. And safety cars were first made uniform and across all races only in 1992. In 1992. In 1971, a year after the spectators were asked to move at least 3 meters behind the track. Now, come on, man. This is really arbitrary, right? Like, it's not even a line like, you know, that they draw in metro stations in Delhi saying, like, please stand behind this as a train approaches. It's, right. Can you stand at least 3 meters behind the racetrack as these drivers drive past? An entire year later, they decided to put up barriers between the fans and the cars. So, right. Yeah, I totally wasn't making this up. This is how, fluid and frivolous the rules once were. It's not the case anymore, as we've seen with, you know, Grosjean's incident over the weekend. I just want to wrap this episode up with a positive story, a story on just how much these Formula One drivers can withstand, because they really are an incredible species. The person who I want to talk about is a lesser known driver known, his name is Alex Zanardi. He used to drive for Williams back in the 90s. In fact, that was his second coming in Formula One when he was already quite an old man. After he left Formula One, when he didn't have a contract anymore, he was driving in the Indy series in America, where while leading one particular race, he lost control after coming out of a pit stop and crashed into another car and lost both his legs. They were amputated, right? So one at the knee and one even higher at the thigh. Wow. This is 2001. Two years later, this man with no legs, two prosthetic legs, climbs back into an IndyCar at Monza and was competing by 2003. In 2006, he tested a Formula One car again, a BMW Sauber, in the off-season to renew hope of being not just the oldest Formula One driver at that point, but, you know, an amputee Formula One driver. It didn't happen, but he was just really, really, really thankful of the chance to just drive that beast again, right? But his story doesn't end there. In 2012, he participated in the London Paralympics in hand cycling because, you know, you just can't stop this guy.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's Alex Zanardi, and that's pretty much the Formula One driver prototype, right? Like, these guys basically can survive absolutely everything thrown at them, and a lot of it is because of just how safe the sport has become now. This was an episode of A View from the Stands. Do like and follow us on at HT Smartcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or write to us on podcasts@hindustantimes.com. You can listen to more podcasts by logging on to htsmartcast.com.
This was a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.